Good evening. My name is David McKnight. I am the director of Penn Library's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. I would like to welcome you on behalf of the University Libraries to this evening's lecture, which inaugurates the 2012 Muriel Flaeser Bodeck Lecture Series. Established in 2001, the Bodeck Lectures focuses on public policy writ large. Since the lecture series' creation 11 years ago, seven lectures have been given on a wide range of topics, including the exploration of failing government institutions, disinformation, ethics in a morally divided America, gun barrel democracy, enemy aliens, and I'm not sure what aliens mean here, aliens and American freedoms, living in a post-9/11 world, America's Middle East policy, and the ethical dilemma of cloning technologies. This year, the Bodeck Lectures turn to the subject of food policy under the rubric of American Pie, the politics of food in the 21st century. I have asked whether this is a sugar-free pie, but I'm afraid not, so I'm going to have to pass on it. Over the course of the next three Wednesdays, we will be treated to three lectures delivered by respective experts in the field of food studies. Tonight's lecturer is Jonathan Bloom, of whom you will learn more shortly. On April 19th, Dr. Alan M. Kelly will speak on the challenges of global food security. And finally, on April 24th, Dr. John E. Eichard will explore the subject of sustainable food. So I hope you have bookmarked the lecture series, and I look forward to seeing you at the upcoming lectures. While this series focuses on three aspects of food policy, I would like to remind you that the Rare Book and Manuscript Library is actively building its culinary collections, which include the Esther B. Aresti Collection on Rare Books on the Culinary Arts, the Laurie Burroughs Grad Cookbook Collection, and the Chef Fritz Blank Culinary Archive and Library. These collections provide rich contextual resources for researchers interested not only in the culinary arts, but illustrate broader themes which document the use and preparation of food in the context of social and cultural practice and their derivative meaning. Having the material text in hand for the purposes of teaching and research is perhaps one of the Rare Book Library's greatest roles and speaks to our collective values. To learn more about these collections, please visit our Culinary Collections website and collection guide. I would now like to present Ms. Lynn Farrington, curator of printed books. Lynn has masterminded this year's Bodeck Lecture Series, and Lynn will introduce this evening's speaker, Jonathan Bloom. Please welcome Lynn Farrington.
Thank you, David. And I want to thank all of you for coming this evening to the first in what I know will be a stimulating series of lectures addressing food policy in the 21st century. From the RSVPs we received, the audience for this series is wide-ranging and includes not only Penn students, faculty, and staff, but also a sizable number of people from the greater Philadelphia community. And I must say, this pleases me immensely. American Pie, The Politics of Food in the 21st Century, is sponsored, as David told you, by the Penn Libraries through the Muriel Flaeser Bodeck Public Affairs Fund. Established in 2001 by Gordon S. Bodeck College, 1942, in honor of his wife, Muriel, this fund generously supports a lecture series on current public affairs. And I understand that Gordon and Muriel's son, Hanley, is in the audience this evening, and I would like to extend our thanks to his family for making this series of lectures possible. American Pie is co-sponsored by the School of Veterinary Medicine, the School of Nursing, and the School of Arts and Sciences Nutrition Minor, the Department of the History and Sociology of Science, Agustin Urban Nutrition Initiative, part of the Netter Center of Community Partnerships, the Environmental Kitchen at Penn Women's Center, the Penn Vegan Society, and Penn Appetit, which is, in their words, the University of Pennsylvania's innovative student-run magazine covering all things food. I end the list with them because the current editor-in-chief, Isha Sadesai, is one of my undergraduate advisees, and the impetus for organizing this series really started with our conversation about food studies at Penn during her freshman year. Out of these initial conversations, we began to explore the idea of bringing together faculty, students, and staff here at Penn with an interest in any and all aspects of food. My own interest as curator of printed books in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library stems in part from the various food-related collections that I oversee, which David just mentioned. And they include also the library of the Philadelphia Society for Promoting Agriculture, one of the oldest agricultural societies in this country, and it's still running. There may be people from that here tonight, and I hope so. I want to thank everyone who, over these past 2 years, has played a role in the discussions about food studies at Penn. Our discussions revealed to me the vibrant but also the diffuse nature of this field, which touches on just about every discipline. In an attempt to draw the community together, we in the library have developed a website called Food Studies at Penn, which you can find with a simple Google search. Courses, events, organizations, and other related information can be found there. We actually think of the library as one of the interdisciplinary centers of the university. So thanks to the Penn Libraries for their support of this series and the larger Food Studies project. Special thanks go to Kristen Winch in Library Development, who was immediately supportive when I went to her with the idea for this series, to Janet Crisan, who made suggestions for speakers when I first approached her last year, to Alita Arthurs, the library's events planner, who helped with many of the details, and last but certainly not least, to Erin McLean, who's in the audience tonight, my intern from Drexel, who's just graduated, who hopes to combine food and librarianship in her career and who is instrumental in developing the publicity for this series. Thank you, Erin. Before I introduce our speaker, I want to remind you of the other two lectures in this series, and I know David mentioned them. He said they were on the following two Wednesdays. In fact, the next one's on Thursday. Next Thursday, Alan Kelly will be speaking, and the title of his talk is Global Food Security, a 21st Century Challenge. And that lecture will take place in Room 30 of the New Hill Pavilion at the Vet School. The following Tuesday, April 24th, we will return to this room to hear Dr. John Ickert, Professor Emeritus of Agricultural Economics at the University of Missouri, speak on sustainable agriculture. The title of his talk is The Future of Food, Sustainable Agriculture is Not Optional. And I hope to see many of you at these two lectures as well. Now to this evening's speaker. Jonathan Bloom is a journalist and blogger who writes about why we waste food, why it matters, and what we can do about it. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. He lives with his wife and son in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and as I discovered this morning on the drive back from the airport, grew up in Wellesley, Massachusetts, which is familiar territory to me as the home of my undergraduate institution. His recent book, American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It, received the 2011 International Association of Culinary Professionals Cookbook Award for books on food matters. I like the use of the word matters here with its double meaning, referring to things having to do with food as well as to the importance of food. Yes, food matters matter. Reading American Wasteland, I was struck by many things, but I will only mention a few. First, I was struck by how Jonathan's sensibility about waste corresponds to my own. I, too, for one example, must admit to being annoyed by the rough and inattentive handling of produce by cashiers and prefer to pack my own groceries. My father, who grew up during the Depression and who also traveled the globe as a young man in the Merchant Marine, regularly reminded my sisters and me of the children in India when food remained on our plates at the end of a meal. Moreover, when we brought boyfriends home, he always commented on whether they were good eaters, i.e., ate what was served to them or not. Like Jonathan, I'm a cheapskate, a product of my New England Puritan upbringing, and hate wasting food. I can be regularly seen carrying home leftovers after going out to dinner, though I too have to admit that there are times when food in my refrigerator has turned a fluorescent color and I have to throw it out rather than risk poisoning myself. A native of Maine, I appreciate the segment in his book on St. Joseph's College, where food waste, as well as water and energy use, was greatly reduced simply by getting rid of trays in the cafeteria. A side benefit of this was less overeating by students as well, an easier way, I think, to help keep off the freshman 15. When I took a look at Jonathan's website and blog, www.wastedfood.com, which has lots of great information, and I highly recommend it to you if you're interested in this topic. I saw a link to a page called Tray Lists. In addition to a list of schools that have links to web pages discussing their activities regarding trayless cafeterias, there are a few like the University of Pennsylvania, about which Jonathan writes, "I've heard that these schools have gone trayless, but I can't find links." I couldn't find anything either on the web, so I did the easiest thing possible. I asked a recent graduate who works for me, and she told me that the dining halls did go trayless, 4 years ago when she was a sophomore. I also wrote to Tatiana Emerson, the marketing manager for Bon Appetit, who now runs the Penn dining facilities, and was told, "It is true, we do not use trays. In fact, practically all Bon Appetit accounts across the country are trayless. We have very few trays, just in case a guest requests one." So, Jonathan, you can now confirm on your website that Penn is indeed trayless. With this, I'd like to turn the podium over to Jonathan Bloom. Thank you.
Good evening. Thanks for that kind introduction, Lynn. If you guys bear with me, I'm now going to update my website to just mark that. Just kidding. I'll do it later, but thank you. And I should thank the Penn Libraries and the Coalition of the Willing departments who have made this evening possible, and also the Bodek family. It's great to be here. So I got into town a little bit earlier than expected today, and I had a couple hours to look around. And so I thought I'd start out tonight's talk by sharing a couple pictures that I was able to take of food that has been or had been squandered on campus. Okay, just kidding. I wouldn't do that to you. I'm not that kind of guy. I did want to start out on a different tack, thinking about what an interesting time it is for environmentalism. And in particular, how you have certain issues and causes that are readily adopted while others languish. And from where I stand, it can be a bit odd which issues gain traction and which ones don't. So, for example, take this pristine piece of paper here. If I were to go like that, it's trash. Or is it? I guarantee you, in every community in America, I could frustrate, even anger someone by throwing it out instead of recycling. And certainly that's the case here on campus. Now, same goes for this can of soda. And also, if I were to go like that, littering, and not only would I be going against society's mores, but in many places I'd be breaking the law. At the same time, in every community in America, wasting food is not only accepted, it's widespread. So why that discrepancy? Well, when we have behaviors that we deem worth changing, we often create campaigns to do so. So with littering, you've got the litter bug campaign developed right here in Pennsylvania. And it seems that every city and town has their own recycling campaign or mascot. And that hasn't happened with food waste, at least not since World War II. And the thing about these campaigns is that we've heeded the message, and we've internalized that message to the extent that we'll feel guilty about not recycling that can. But a can of soda could never impact someone's life like a can of soup might. And even throwing away hundreds of cans, while unfortunate, is nowhere near as heartbreaking as what happens behind most supermarkets in America every day, throwing away hundreds of pounds of food. So I draw this parallel with recycling and littering not to denigrate either and not to prompt further littering. I promise I'll pick up that can at the end of the talk. And if I can find a recycling bin, I will put it there. But I draw the parallel to show that when we set our mind toward affecting change, we're quite good at it. So for me, that's exciting because I believe we're about to turn our attention toward food waste. I think it's the next big green thing. So hopefully, by the end of tonight's talk, I'll have convinced you that not only is wasted food a topic worth tackling, but it's one that we can really conquer. Okay, so taking a step back for a moment, there are a few other things I should say. Who am I? I like to include an existential moment in every talk or presentation I give. We've reached that point. But for the purposes of tonight's talk, I am a food waste expert. Believe it or not, I did not grow up wanting to be such a thing. It wasn't like baseball player, then food waste expert. But rather, I've always been passionate about food and then had this mounting environmental interest. And there was one experience that brought the two together. I was volunteering at a food recovery operation called DC Central Kitchen. And for those who haven't heard the term, food recovery is basically the practice of rescuing food from restaurants, supermarkets, caterers, etc., rescuing food that would otherwise be thrown out. And that day at DC Central, I was tasked with making a big vat of pasta. So it wasn't terribly difficult work. I had a good chance to kind of observe what was happening. And I kept seeing all these trays of really nice-looking meats and seafood and produce. And the epiphany I had that day was, you know, if this is being rescued here, what's happening in cities and towns that don't have this kind of food recovery operation? And the question that came to me that day was, how much food is slipping between the cracks? So that was 2005, and I've been basically trying to find answers ever since. After graduating from, I got a master's degree in journalism. When I was volunteering, that was the summer between the 2 years of journalism school. And so I wrote my final project on this topic and then decided to stick with it. And I started Wasted Food to further bring attention to the topic and then was able to publish my book in 2010. And since that time, I've had a neat opportunity to travel around giving talks like this. And I really enjoy the opportunity to have a bit of a dialogue. So hopefully at the end of this talk, we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. So if questions come up, definitely keep those in mind, and I'll look forward to hearing them. All right, so here's a quick overview of what I'll talk about tonight. I'll give you a sense on how much food we're wasting, why we're wasting so much, why it matters, and then the all-important what we can do better. Okay, so quick stats for you. 40% of all the food produced in America isn't used. Another way of saying that is that of all the food raised or grown in America, 40% is not eaten. So a staggering amount, and it certainly adds up. It's about 160 billion pounds, comes at a cost of almost $250 billion, and on the household level, certainly we're squandering plenty there as well. About a quarter of what we bring home we don't use. So, yeah, I just threw some numbers at you really quickly, but images speak louder than words and numbers. So here's one for you. Every day, we're filling the Rose Bowl with food waste. Every day, America is wasting enough food to fill this 90,000-seat stadium in Southern California. And to bring things a little closer to home, in case you're wondering, the answer is yes. That would be enough food wasted to fill up Franklin Field. So where is all of this waste happening? Where is it coming from? Well, the short answer is everywhere, all throughout the food chain. It starts on farms, where many times foods never leave the farm, often due to blemishes or economic issues that cause entire fields not to be harvested when the price of a certain crop gets to be so low that it doesn't justify the investment. These are pears that I witnessed at an orchard in California that just weren't quite good enough for the fresh market. And if any of you have been to self-pick orchards or have spent much time on that or in an orchard, you'll know that there's plenty of food that goes to ground there. The waste continues on to the supermarket level, often caused by expiration dates or sell-by dates, often also caused by things not looking just so. And this picture is from a supermarket where I worked as part of the research for this book. And a quick little anecdote for you. My first day of work, the first thing they told me to do before they even gave me a name tag was to go to this wall of refrigerated bagged salads and cut fruit and just to start pulling things that had a sell-by date of that day. And I was kind of hoping that they might find an alternate use for those foods, but it wasn't to be. Later on, they had me throw them out. So before I even had a name tag, I was throwing away food. And that's just kind of business as usual in U.S. supermarkets. The waste continues on to the restaurant level, and also college cafeterias are no stranger to wasted food. This image here is from a place called Reed College, which some of you might have heard of. It's a small school in Portland, Oregon. And they have this really interesting phenomenon there called scrounging. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of that. But basically, what it is that there are students who decide they're not going to get a meal plan. They're going to subsist off the leftovers of their peers. So kind of like, it is what it sounds like. But it's really ingrained, and it's a cultural phenomenon there that's been happening since the 60s. So it's actually, well, it's possible and even respected in some ways. But this picture here, these are dishes of pasta that the scrounge table didn't even want. So this is food that has been essentially wasted twice. And I thought that told a nice story. And finally, the waste continues on to the household level, where we often create this situation, kind of like what Lynn mentioned, where we just couldn't possibly get to everything in our refrigerator before it goes bad. And in case you're wondering how I got this picture of your household refrigerator, let's just say I have my ways. Okay, so what's going on here? Why are we wasting so much food? 40%. It's crazy. Well, number one, food is tremendously cheap. Now, I like this image because, number one, it conveys the cheapness of food. It doesn't get much more inexpensive than 99 cents a pound. It also has a timely bit of cultural insensitivity. Happy Passover, everyone. Please pass the pork ribs. But anyway, when I say food is cheap, you might think, well, hold on a sec. Food prices have been going up steadily. And that is true. But when you look at the percentage of household spending that goes toward food, it's at an all-time low. And no other nation in the world spends as little on food as we do. And that certainly has an impact in how we treat our food. Put simply, we don't tend to value things we don't spend much on. And I should point out that it is an artificial cheapness. The cheapness of food is prompted by subsidies that go toward commodity crops. So you could make the argument that food is too cheap, as some people do with gasoline, and that it should be more expensive. But that is a tricky proposition to make when so many people don't have enough food. But it's certainly a rich discussion. The other thing about the cheapness of food is that we will pay for it later through health issues and problems. We are essentially writing an IOU in terms of the national healthcare costs that go along with some of the illnesses linked to eating disorders like diabetes and obesity. All right, next up, food is abundant. We produce about twice the amount of calories that we need. And given that, it's not terribly surprising that we turn around and waste almost half of what we produce. This image is from a gleaning outing that I went to not too far from where I live in North Carolina. And these are all sweet potatoes that would have just been plowed under. And the thing about this image is that that's just a fraction of what we recovered on one morning, on one blue sky day in North Carolina. We could have been out there for a week and still not rescued all the food that was going to be plowed under. And that's happening across the country. The thing about abundance is that we see food everywhere. It's piled high at the supermarket. And we come across food pretty much everywhere we go. It's not only at the food stores, it's at pharmacies, convenience stores, gas stations, big box retailers. I even saw some food in a Staples the other day. And so what that does is it creates this notion in our mind that we don't have to be careful with our food because there's plenty of it. And there is. So as a result, we treat it cavalierly. The next driver of waste is superficiality with our food. And what I mean by that is that we've reached this point where appearance trumps taste. And so in order to have that pristine display of apples, you have this culling process all throughout the food chain from farm to fork. And I was actually part of that process. When I worked at the store, my boss told me to go through the displays once or twice a day, and anything that looked just a bit off, I had to pull. And now I understand if you're at the supermarket and you see an apple that's a little blemished and there's one that's perfect, you're going to buy the one that's perfect. But that doesn't mean that the other one's trash. So we need to do a better job there. The other thing about superficiality is it dooms so much food to the waste bin when anything is just the wrong shape, size, or color, off by a tiny bit even. Oftentimes there's no place for it in our food system. So I talked to a cucumber grower who was just beside himself because he had to throw away these curved cucumbers because they pack them 48 to the box, and if they're curved, you can't fit as many in a box. So there was no way that he could find to get around that problem. All right, the next issue and the next waste driver are the massive portions that we receive at so many restaurants today. I'm going to be honest with you, I have no idea what that is a picture of. I'm pretty sure that involves eggs and cheese. I'm also pretty sure that it's about twice the amount of food that you'd want to eat in one sitting. And sadly, this is not a rare sight. We're often put in this position at restaurants where we can either overeat or waste food. And sometimes, if we get enough food, we could actually do both, sadly. Now, there's a better way, taking leftovers home, but you might not be going straight home. Some people don't like leftovers. So this is a real issue that leads to so much waste at the restaurant level. What is called plate waste in the industry. And I was driving around, and I saw this sign, and I was struck. I had to pull over and take a picture because I was just taken aback by the overtness of using portion size as a lure. And certainly not the only lure at this restaurant, as they are one to admit, but just shocking in how they would use that. And I have to say, I have never been in such an establishment, but I have to doubt their use of the adjective great in relation to their food. But that's just a guess. All right. And finally, the last issue in why we waste so much food is a loss of food knowledge. The traditional food ways are not being passed down from generation to generation as they once were. And as a result, we're often unsure if things are good or not, or if we'll get sick eating them. And into that void steps labels like this one, where we're told, when in doubt, throw it out. And in the smaller print, I don't know if you can see it, but they're telling you to use this food within 24 hours. And this is a to-go box I got from a restaurant. Now, using food within 24 hours, that might be good advice if you don't have a refrigerator, but might be a bit extreme if you do. And we're constantly receiving messages like this one. The other thing that really steps into that void of a lack of food knowledge are the expiration dates that are ubiquitous these days. They're not just on bottles of milk anymore, but they're on individual eggs. They're on boxes of cereal and, my favorite, bottles of water. And I don't know about you, but I don't remember the last time I had water that had expired. So the thing about these dates that you probably know is that there's some caution built into them. So if you are treating that date as the gospel truth, you're going to be throwing away some perfectly edible food, for the most part. What you might not know about expiration dates is that the only thing required by federal law to have such a date label is infant formula. So food manufacturers are voluntarily putting these dates on, mostly because it works for them. They want you to eat or drink, as the case may be, their product at its peak freshness. But then, you know, if you treat that label as absolute and you throw that food out and buy more, that works for them as well. And just to illustrate the prevailing attitude that I've found toward things that are past their date, I get a kick out of this comic here. In case you can't read it, it says, "Most creative marketing technique for merchandise past its expiration date award." And the slogan is, "Take a walk on the wild side." And there is this notion that we're taking our life into our own hands if we eat food a minute past the expiration date on the day that we're supposed to eat it by. All right, so what's the big deal? Why do I care? You might be asking yourself that very question. And I actually had that question put to me by an editor at the New York Times. I had a chance to talk to this guy at a conference. I was in journalism school still. I had just started focusing on food waste, and I was really jazzed about it. And I said, you know, hey, I want to write this book about food waste. It's going to be great. It's the next big thing. And he said, yeah, all right, sounds okay, but why do I care? It's the quintessential editor's question, and a good one. And I didn't have a great response. I wanted to say, we should care about food waste just because. Isn't it obvious? Well, anyway, it turns out that's not the stuff of books. Surprise, surprise. But that was really useful for me. I had to go back to the drawing board and create an intellectual argument on why food waste does matter and why you should care. So what I'll talk about tonight is that we should care about food waste because it has dire ethical, environmental, and economic consequences. So we'll go through those one by one. Now, starting off with the ethics. When you think about the ethical implications of food waste, there might be a saying or an expression that comes to mind. Does anything pop into your head? Waste not, want not. Yeah, that's a good one. something you might have heard. I'm looking for something else, though. Something you might have heard from a parent or at the beginning of this lecture from someone who introduced me. Yes, so clean your plate. There are kids starving in China. That's what you said, China. India, some people, the place where people are starving tends to change due to with generations. So the thing about that expression is that it has some good and bad. The bad thing about it is that it's logistically inaccurate. The food on your plate is never going to help anyone else. It's about thinking about those hungry people before food hits your plate. And the other thing is using that as a tactic to get people to eat their food. It invites guilt to the dinner table, where I don't think it belongs. But there's some usefulness to that expression. And there's a kernel of truth, where when so many people have a hard time finding enough to eat, and we're wasting so much food, that just does not sit well with me. So the way I like to put it is that it is morally callous to throw out as much food as we do when so many people are hungry in America and the world. So a lot of people, when they think about hunger in America, they get this image of a 1930s Great Depression bread line, or in this case, a coffee and donuts line. Sounds pretty good, actually. But the thing about American hunger is that it is anything but history. There are more hungry Americans than ever before, partly because there are more Americans than ever before. But when you look at the percentages, and this is what I call the disgrace of plenty, 15% of our households are classified as food insecure. And that essentially means that at one point or another during the year, they weren't sure where their next meal was coming from. So to live in such a wealthy nation and a nation where we're wasting 40% of our food, to have that level of hunger is, put simply, disgraceful. And the thing is, it wouldn't take that much to rectify the situation. If the social and political will existed to end hunger, we could do it overnight, maybe in a week. Redistributing just 2% of the food we currently waste, as you see, would be enough to lift all of those food insecure households above that line of food security. So hopefully that social will starts here. And the thing about this issue, it's really easy to talk about numbers and stats and percentages, but I try to put a human face on it here. This is a couple that I interviewed during the course of research for the book. Their names Roy and Diane. They were homeless for a few years and were off and on, very hungry, begging for food. And they broke down in tears recounting their experiences. And they really stressed to me that in their home life now, they strive so hard to not waste food because they know what it's like to go without. And being at school here, it's probably hard to go through your daily life without being aware of hunger, but maybe you're doing it. But knowing that hunger exists all around us should hopefully provide a bit of motivation to reduce our waste. All right, shifting gears, let's talk about the environmental consequences of food waste. And there are two main implications here. Number one, the resources that go into growing our food that are then squandered when we throw it out. And number two, the methane emissions that come when we throw our food away. So when I talk about resources, mostly I'm thinking about energy or oil. And petroleum is embedded in our food chain to a scary extent. It's in everything that happens from fertilizing, to planting, to harvesting, to processing, to shipping, cooling, even cooking that food in our homes, and then when we're done with it, the diesel used to ship it off to the landfill. So it's a tremendously energy-rich process. A really conservative estimate is that 2% of all U.S. energy consumption is embedded in the food that we ultimately throw out. 2% of all energy we use. Now, it's just a massive amount, but when I'm trying to impress an audience like yourselves, it sounds a little bit small. I was just using that 2% the other way in talking about ending hunger. So here's a better way of thinking of it. You probably remember the Deepwater Horizon oil leak from a few summers back. Of course, that was an ecological disaster that will have adverse consequences for generations. But every year, we're squandering 70 times that amount of oil through the food that we waste. And the other resource that we're wasting at a scary clip is water. And as I'm sure you know, water is increasingly scarce and will only become more so as our planet heats up. Another pretty conservative estimate is that U.S. agriculture uses 80% of all freshwater usage of water. And mostly that's coming through irrigation and in how we choose to grow crops these days. The estimate that I read was that's 40 trillion liters of water embedded in the food that we throw out. 40 trillion liters, what does that look like? Well, 20 trillion 2 liters, you could do it that way. But that's probably not the best visual. So this is Crater Lake. Every year we're using twice that amount of water to create food that we ultimately don't use. And another way of thinking of it is that we're throwing away the water usage that could, but we're throwing away enough water that could provide the usage for 500 million homes. And then there aren't 500 million homes in America. All right, the other environmental implication is the methane that's created when food decomposes in landfills. And what happens is we're throwing away food, it gets covered up and rots without air. And when that happens, methane, a greenhouse gas, is emitted. Perhaps it's not surprising then that sending food to the landfill is not the best idea. It's essentially using a Stone Age technology of digging a hole in the ground and throwing stuff in it. The methane emissions, it's really important to try to reduce methane because it is 23 times as potent at trapping heat as CO2. So not only is it a greenhouse gas, but it's a pretty nasty one. And the thing about methane emissions is that landfills are the number two human-related source. Can anyone guess the number one source? Yes, we must be in Pennsylvania. Yes. All right, and just recently, food became the largest component of that we send to landfills every year. So landfills are helping to emit methane, and food is the largest source of landfill methane. So put simply, we are aiding climate change from our kitchen waste bins. And this image here is a passive methane vent from a landfill near me in Orange County, North Carolina, and it's just slowly seeping methane into the environment. Now, the larger landfills are required to have some sort of capture system, but the best estimates that I've heard are that they only capture about 50 to 60% of the methane. And the other thing is that even after a landfill closes, the methane creation continues. So it's something we're gonna have to contend with for a long time. And one of the projects that I've been involved with recently is trying to get a handle on exactly what the environmental impact of food waste looks like. And so I'm working with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization to create this global food waste footprint, or food wastage in the EU speak. And that should be out at the end of this year. So stay tuned for that. All right, and the economics of food waste are fairly straightforward, so I don't dwell on them too long, but quite simply, it's a poor use of economic resources to be throwing away as much food as we are. On a national level, I mentioned before about $250 billion. On the household level, this might be of interest to some of you, we could be saving upwards of $2,000 for a family of four. So certainly nothing to sneeze at. Savings could come with taxpayer dollars in particular, with things like the National School Lunch Program, which works wonders in feeding hungry kids, but some of the ways it's done could be altered to reduce the waste there. If you've ever had the chance to visit a school where students are forced to take certain items, and you're always forced to take at least 3 out of 5 items, sometimes there isn't any choice, you'll see trash cans full of unopened milks that students, even if they say, "I don't like milk," they have to take. And whole fruits and vegetables. Vegetables isn't a huge shock to have kids wasting vegetables. Whole apples and oranges. Seems like there should be a better way. And I should also state here that we'll never completely eliminate waste, so we wouldn't realize that entire $240 billion of savings, but we could certainly do a lot better. Okay, so we've reached the all-important point here. What can we do? Wouldn't it really stink if I said there was nothing to do? It's time to go home. No, fortunately, there's plenty that we can do. There's a really useful mantra that I'm sure you've heard: reduce, reuse, recycle. And the thing about that saying is that we often focus on the recycling, but reducing the amount of food waste we create, or the amount of waste of anything, is the more important thing. And that's why it's first. That's why it's at the top of this hierarchy. The problem is that asks us to change our behavior. And that's not the easiest thing. So it's a lot easier to just get people to recycle or compost the food that they take when they take too much or when they're overserved. Now, the EPA has put out this very helpful food waste recovery hierarchy on how to approach our food, and it's echoing that model, that reduce, reuse, recycle. So at the top there, in case you can't read it, says source reduction, basically another way of saying reduce the amount of food waste we're creating. If we can't do that, feed hungry people with that excess food. If we can't do that, feed animals. If we can't do that, industrial uses is another way of saying create energy, or send that food waste to rendering plants. And then if that's not possible, then we should be composting that food waste. And right down at the bottom, landfill. So if we can't do any of the above, landfilling our food should be the last resort. Unfortunately, 97% of the food waste we create ends up in a landfill. So there's plenty of room for improvement. Now, in thinking about the changes that we need or that we could see, I'd like to split it up into the larger or society-wide changes and then some of the individual behavior shifts that you can do in your personal lives. So on the larger level, there's a fair amount of legislation that I'd love to see, but narrowing it down, if I had 3 wishes, it would be these 3 things. Number 1, banning organic materials from landfills. So basically making it illegal to throw away food or other organics. Now, if we were to enact such a thing, it would send ripple effects back through the food chain. It would change how we approach food at all levels. And it's not a pipe dream. It's happening in a few places. It's happening in Norway, in Nova Scotia, and to good effect. And number two there, the EU has recently set a goal of 50% waste reduction by 2025. And I think that's a really useful way of approaching this solution. If we don't know how much better we have to get, then how are we going to improve? We saw it in California, where there was an overall waste reduction goal that was set. And I believe on campus here, you have a certain goal that you're trying to reach by 2014. It gives you something to shoot for. And finally, funding some sort of food recovery or gleaning initiative. I'm envisioning a Service Corps, an AmeriCorps kind of program where idealistic young folks like yourselves are out there organizing and also recovering food that would otherwise not be used. If there's perfectly good food going to waste and nutritious food at that, let's try to harness some of that food. This guy here, his name is Joel Berg, and he was the food recovery coordinator at the USDA in the late 90s. There was not such a position before his time, and there hasn't been one since. So my point here is, in a federal apparatus of about 2 million people, is it too much to ask to have one person whose job it is to think about food waste reduction and food recovery? I think not. And what the third item here, society-wide changes, I'd love to see better data on this topic. People ask me all the time, where is the most waste coming from? Or what sector of the food chain wastes the most? And we don't have that all-encompassing study that really looks at each segment of the food chain. The last all-inclusive study done here in the U.S. was in 1997. The USDA did that using 1995 data, so not all that recent. By contrast, this image here comes from the UK, where they've poured a lot of resources into researching the topic, getting better data, and getting the message out through these really neat-looking awareness materials. And it's working. The media has latched onto it. The public has started to pay attention to wasted food, and the levels of waste are decreasing. The thing about this picture that I always chuckle at is like the anthropomorphization of food. I always find that a bit strange. Like, would this pear really be sad if it wasn't going to be eaten? But anyway, we can discuss that later. All right, finally, the last big change I'd love to see is a public awareness campaign, whether it's similar to what we saw in Britain or something like the Litterbug campaign or my good friend Woodsy the Owl. I don't know if anyone remembers this. Am I dating myself here? Anyway, Woodsy the Owl taught kids not to pollute in the woods or start forest fires. Oh, no, wait, that was Smokey the Bear. Anyway, some sort of campaign to get kids thinking about food waste and not wasting food, I think, would be invaluable. All right, now it's time to empower you all. And just a quick anecdote before I get into some of these potential changes you can make in your own lives. There was a study done in a New York county, and they looked at waste at all different segments of their waste stream, and they found that households produce the most by volume. So there's good and bad news there. The bad news is that we're pretty darn wasteful as individuals, as households. The good news is that we can have a real impact, and we have a role to play. So here are some things you can do. when you're at the cafeteria, especially at an all-you-can-eat cafeteria or even at a restaurant, be aware of how much food you're taking. I know it sounds like basic advice, but if you are thinking about this image of, well, maybe not this image, that might be a bit of an extreme. If you're thinking about this image, then maybe you will approach the amount of food you take or order a bit differently. We heard a lot about traylessness. It's very important, and I'm heartened to hear that that is happening and is alive and well. So keep up the good work there. The other thing that's really, really important is connecting with your food, whether it's growing your own or buying it from a local farmer. You can ask about how they grow certain things or their methods, or even just cooking your own food. When you're involved in creating what you eat, quite simply, you're not going to waste as much food. It's going to be near impossible. When you know the effort and the energy that goes into growing and cooking food, you're going to treasure it, and you're not going to treat it like any other commodity, as you might if you buy it shrink-wrapped in that styrofoam package. Shopping smarter is so important as well. Basically, avoiding that situation where we have so much food in our fridge that we couldn't possibly use all of it. If you don't mind shopping, then making those smaller trips to smaller trips to the store is important. If you are going to go once a week, then it's important or vital to plan out your meals and then make a detailed shopping list and stick to it. Just be careful if you let your kids make a shopping list. You might end up with some dicey things on it. I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be snacks, but I don't know. Also, it's a nice little shout out to Chef Boyardee, which takes me back. Okay, we talked a little bit about expiration dates before, but my best advice here is to not pay much attention to them, to treat them as a guideline on, you know, to give you a ballpark on when that food is still good or not. They're not written in stone. They're printed on your food. So treat them that way. Food can go bad before it's said to on that package as well. So that's why it's really important to trust your senses instead of blindly following expiration dates. And we've developed these senses, the looking at your food, smelling it, maybe even tasting it. We've developed them over millennia, so I think you'll be surprised at how trustworthy they can be. And if there's anyone out there who isn't sure if they've ever had bad milk, you haven't. The other thing I should say about date labels is that there are different terms. There's so many that it gets confusing. There's, you know, sell by, best by, used before, best before, best if consumed by. So it gets a bit much, but basically they're all guidelines on food quality, not food safety. And the other thing is that sell by dates are something that we really shouldn't even be paying attention to because they are aimed at retailers to let them know how long they should display something. So those sell-by dates give people 7 to 10 days to bring the food home and eat it, depending on the item. All right, next, we really need to make doggy bags cool. And I'm not talking about this kind of doggy bag, definitely not this kind, but rather taking food home from restaurants. It's the green thing to do. It's economical. It's your food. You paid for it. Why throw it away? So removing any kind of stigma there might be. I've had a hard time, as someone who always takes food home from restaurants, as you might guess, I had a hard time kind of understanding why someone wouldn't. But, you know, social stigma is probably one of the larger ones. And I think we're at the point here where we could just say, forget that. Like, we can get past that. So next time you're at a really fancy restaurant, ask them for a to-go box. And you'll be sort of leading the charge. Another way we can help is by volunteering, whether it's in gleaning, like we see here. This is from the big gleaning day in North Carolina called the Yam Jam. But getting out into the fields is a great way to experience agriculture, to get out to some bucolic settings you might not always get to visit, and to recover a whole lot of food, as you saw from that truckload of sweet potatoes. But also volunteering could look like this at food recovery places. Here in Philadelphia, there's a great group called Philabundance, and I'm sure they'd be happy to have some helping hands. And this is actually a pretty sweet gig. This is the Fancy Food Festival in New York, where they were recovering all kinds of gourmet goodies. See, it looks fun, doesn't it? And finally, if we can't do any of those things, then it's really important to make a commitment to composting. I know when the earth talks, I tend to listen. And the earth is talking. I was excited to hear that there is composting on campus at dining halls. I was less excited to see this this poster that I got from the Sustainability Office's website, which is, I guess it was, well, you probably have seen it, you know, trying to get people to recycle and not contaminate the recycling. But on a progressive campus like this one, hopefully the next five-year plan can include a better way of treating our food waste, so making composting more available, more readily available, not just in cafeterias, but campus-wide. So there's something to shoot for. All right, and I wanted to leave you with this thought here, and thinking about the stakes of wasted food. The stakes are pretty high. We are running out of time when we think about our planet in terms of the environmental impact of climate change, and also just in population growth. So the estimates are that by 2050, there will be 9 billion of us on this here globe. It's a lot of zeros and certainly a lot of mouths to feed. So the development people, when they think about that number and how we're going to feed all those people, they automatically jump to increased production or GMO crops. And those are other discussions for other days. But my point here is, before we do that, let's think about efficiency. Let's try to be more efficient with the food we do produce. And I think that that word is going to become increasingly important in development circles and agricultural circles. So we're going to have to become more efficient with our food supply sooner or later. And my vote would be for sooner. So with that, I thank you for your time, and I would love to hear your thoughts and questions. And I guess there is a microphone if you care to use it.
Yep. If you want to raise your hand, we can give you a microphone if you've got questions.
I feel that you're missing the point a little bit here.
Okay.
I heard you say the word commodity once. And a lot of these problems, it seems clear to me, didn't just happen. It's because of policies and through, you know, lots of folks benefiting from this. You know, there are a lot of corporations who are benefiting from this system. And our lack of knowledge of our food isn't just incidental. So I think that's something we really need to address. more so than just, you know. And also, one other thing is you can't smell or taste Listeriosis. And this comes from someone who drinks sour raw milk, so.
Sorry, say that last bit again. You can't taste what?
You can't taste or smell Listeriosis. Hmm.
Okay. Well, you raise some good points. Certainly, there aren't too many food companies that are going poor, right? Or that are struggling as much as individuals are. What I would say to that is I usually include a bit about policy, but you're correct. In the 70s, there was this policy expressed by the Secretary of Ag, grow from fence row to fence row, like maximum production. We're going to try to outgrow the Soviets. And that has had an impact that has produced the abundance that we have today that should have created lower prices, but doesn't, in part because we're not using all that we grow. So certainly there's a situation where I think food companies can gain some positive publicity from trying to reduce waste, but as I mentioned, like with those expiration dates, they actually are benefiting from those, and it's leading to a lot of food going to waste. So I talked to that guy that I showed there, Joel Berg, who was the food recovery coordinator. He is less excited about reducing waste as a means to ending hunger than I am. I don't think that it's the only thing that we need to do to reduce hunger. I think it's one way to approach the problem, but certainly we need to tackle this issue from multiple angles.
Hi. Number one, thanks for the lecture. I think that definitely, I guess, hearkening on our last commenter's points, particularly in response to questions about expiration dates, is the amount of legal pressure put on labeling for different products coming out of, I guess, the pressure coming out of corporate, what am I trying to say, like law offices, people that are actually protecting major food companies. The idea that if somebody were to consume something after a certain date, now they can sue us if we haven't labeled it correctly. And so there's kind of this pressure to make the date sooner and sooner once these items actually come out of the production facilities, which themselves are usually less sanitary because they're trying to produce so much product in such a short period of time on such a low budget that it's now complicating food sanitation issues. So I guess, you know, in order to address something like that, I guess what have you done in perhaps your writing, also perhaps, I guess, in your advocacy in order to try to elucidate more of, I guess, the annoying and often boring technicalities of law and corporate business and expectations?
Okay, that's a great question. So I try to be the common sense approach here. If I had a team of lawyers, they probably would not be happy with what I say. I think that there's real room for policy change, in particular with the sell-by date confusion. And that's where this has gone in Europe, where they have pushed to ban sell-by dates or actually make them closed to consumers. They call it closed dating so that people can't see it because it just confuses people. But in terms of advocacy or what I've been doing on this issue, I mean, basically, I tried to distinguish between like foodborne illnesses, which really have nothing to do with expiration dates, and then that date, which speaks to quality more than safety. And certainly, we live in a country where there are plenty of people looking for a lawsuit. As I understand it, you're not able to sue a company because of that date. For me, it seems like we're never going to completely repeal those dates, so it's not a great way to spend your energy. But what we could do is make it so those sell-by dates are not visible to consumers.
Hi. I feel like, and you very much touched on this earlier, but I feel like the whole problem of waste is tied up in this vicious circle of food being too cheap, and so producers have to produce more in order to make enough money off of their operation, and that leads to more waste, et cetera, et cetera. So what do you envision in terms of policy-wise about increasing food prices so that we're not in this vicious circle where farmers have to overproduce in order to make a living out of their farm?
First of all, I mean, as I kind of hinted at, I mean, I don't really think we should go about raising food prices as a policy. I mean, I think you could start subsidizing different things and then kind of let that happen through the free market. But I think a better way of approaching things would be to support local agriculture and local food systems where you're supporting smaller farmers. You know that you're helping them get by and make a decent wage, and you're not really concerned with, you know, the macroeconomic issues here, and you're not paying for the cross-country shipping, you're not paying for the marketing that goes into producing that food or making it appealing to consumers, and you're not paying for the waste that's inherent in our system. The waste is, certainly the cost of waste is built into food prices. And as I mentioned before, you know, the big food manufacturers are quite profitable and they're doing just fine. My answer is to spend your food dollar wisely and try to grow your own or support local growers. And that's not going to completely solve that issue of abundance. Farmers are people who will always grow more rather than less, just in case something goes wrong. But when that happens, that's when I'd love to see a kind of safety net for our food. So that's where gleaning could come in, or even just having harvested stuff that isn't going to sell, having that donated.
You pointed out earlier that the data is scarce, so you may not have the information to answer this question, but it seems to me that a lot of the examples that you've been giving of waste either come from food that is, you know, being purchased in restaurants, you know, people dining out, or shopping the perimeter of the supermarket. And it seems to me that an awful lot of, you know, particularly when you're talking about large food corporations, you're talking about processed food, which has got a longer shelf life, it's more stability. Now, I'm just wondering, you know, when you talk about the waste that's happening, can you, it might be helpful in targeting, you know, the problem and coming up with solutions as to knowing where the majority of the waste is happening. Is it the fresh foods that are in the perimeter of the supermarket? Is it the food that's purchased, you know, prepared for sale? Do you have any information on that?
So just to clarify, you're asking about at the supermarkets where the most or throughout the food chain.
You say 40% of food is being wasted, but is 80% of that prepared food for sale or fresh foods in supermarkets?
As you mentioned, there isn't that all-encompassing study, but for sure the most unused food is happening on farms. And in some ways that's a good thing because it's usually just plowed under and the nutrients help replenish the soil. It's much better than sending it to the landfill. But it's also really frustrating because that's food that's the most nutritious, could be used to nourish people who need it. So that's, to me, where I think there's an opportunity to make some real change. And at the supermarkets, I mean, I can tell you're really interested in that level. But certainly the fresh food as a whole is what's being squandered. And what I found is that stores have this attitude that, especially with produce, if you don't have a certain amount of waste, then that means you're not culling your displays enough, you're not being picky enough, essentially. So it's viewed as somewhat of a lost leader, and stores know that shoppers choose their supermarket based largely on the produce section. So they're willing to take a hit there to keep you coming back.
Okay, I think we're going to call it night tonight and thank Jonathan for being here and for speaking to us tonight. And thank you very much for coming.
All right. Thanks.